Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Fishing supplies for all our subsistence fishermen are gone.
Norton Sound communities take stock of their losses in the wake of the weekend storm. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 21st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, damage to seawalls and protective berms has some village residents worried.
We need financial assistance ASAP. Our lives are at stake.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
At a joint meeting last night, Chivac Native Village and the City of Chivac declared a state of emergency after the remnants of Typhoon Murbach destroyed most of the community's storage sheds that hold gear and supplies for fishing and hunting. Reporter Emily Schwing is in Chivac, roughly 140 miles west of Bethel. Emily, what can you tell us about the damages there in Chivac?
Well, there's been a minimal amount of damage to houses and buildings in the community. Yesterday when I flew in, I was honestly a little bit surprised at how little damage there appeared to be. But all that changed for me when you head out to the bluff above the Chivac River at the front of town. Along the riverbank, there are boats, fishing floats, gas cans, and piles of gear all tangled up in fishing nets, and it's all strewn all over the place.
Yeah, sounds like a mess. Well, Emily, tell us what community leaders are doing to get a handle on the extent of the storm's destruction.
So over at the city, they're trying to coordinate with a few state agencies. The Department of Transportation is sending a team of 7 people out next week to assess potential damage to the airport runway. Although I didn't see very much damage when I flew in. More immediately, the Native Village of Chivac hired 2 temporary employees this morning. They're going to help assess damages and losses that people suffered in the community. Scott Ulron grew up here in Chivac. He's 37, and he spent most of his day taking reports from his friends and neighbors about what they had lost.
People need this, so that's why I stepped forward to help them gather the information they need on broken property and just give a helping hand to all those who are in need of it.
He sounds a little emotional there, and this is clearly not easy work to be documenting all the damage to his home community. How are people holding up out there?
Yeah, you know, emotions are really running high in this community right now. There's not been any loss of life. Nobody was injured, and they're really thankful for that. But many people, including Clinton Slats, have told me it's just really hard to put into words what it means to lose their boats and all their fishing and hunting gear. Even so, it's still really impressive how resilient people are being right now.
It's all right. We're all alive and we're good. That's all that really matters. These stuff can be replaced one way or another.
So yeah, not losing lives is really important. But then of course, losing those boats, that can affect their subsistence harvesting. And then even with just the capsized boats comes the potential for fuel spills, right? So what do you know about any possible environmental contamination?
Yeah, the loss of all these boats and gear really has an impact with respect to food security. And same with some of these potential fuel spills. The city reported a sheen on the river a few days ago. I didn't see that today, but there are a number of gas cans along the river that are overturned. Ryan Bukowski was at the community building to report damages to his own boat, and he says the environmental safety side of this is a very real concern for people.
Battery acid, hydraulic oil, coolant, there's people's leftover fuel, there's used engine oil, there's old boat motors and things that have contamination in them that are now in the water.
So Emily, along with all of that, I wonder about the community's access to water and electricity. What can you tell us about the situation with running water there and power?
Yeah, so the village does have electricity. The power is working, and they do also have running water here. But everyone is on a boil water notice, including at the school. During the storm, the power was knocked out for quite some time, and that apparently impacted the machinery over at the wastewater plant that helps the sewer system operate. There is a lot of concern that the drinking water here may have been contaminated, but the community hasn't received any outside deliveries of drinking water or bottled water. Everybody is just boiling their water for 2 minutes before they drink it.
Okay, well, we will stay tuned to your reporting out there. That was Alaska Public Media reporter Emily Schwing talking to us from CHIVAC. Emily, thanks for the update.
Yeah, thanks, Casey.
Several Norton Sound communities are struggling with contaminated drinking water days after last weekend's storm hit the region. KNOM's Davis Hovey reports.
In Stebbins, City Administrator Daisy Lockwood Kachiak says 8 families were displaced and there is still 6 to 8 feet of standing water throughout the community.
Our sand that pushed up maybe 6 to 8 feet, causing displacement of homes, and 100% of the fish racks and fishing supplies for all our subsistence fishermen are gone.
Since Stebbins is heavily reliant on a subsistence diet, Kachiak says they have made a request to the Red Cross and to Norton Sound Health Corporation in Nome for food deliveries. No serious injuries have been reported, nor deaths, and all residents in Stebbins are accounted for. That strong sense of community and locals' efforts to take care of each other lets Kachiak know that Stebbins is going to be okay.
Stebbins is still standing. Stebbins is resilient. Stebbins is busy creating unity and to put our community back together.
Stebbins is one of several Alaskan communities that has not yet been set up with running water. Instead, the community relies on a washateria and pipes in water from a local lake that is then treated in a water tank before residents use it. Following the storm, the community is not on a boil water notice, but other eastern Norton Sound communities are, specifically Unalakleet, Koyuk, and Elam. Elam City Manager Clarence Acuse says the community had lifted the boil water notice for a month prior to the storm, but not anymore.
And our water source was compromised, but since then, locals had opened the creek so the water could flow, and it flowed right away, so...
Elam's main roads were heavily eroded, including the 2 paved roads near the coast and the road to Moses Point. Besides clearing debris and cleaning up, Secu says Elam's priority is to save one resident that's in a precarious position.
Our major concern now is the home that's almost fallen off the cliff. We need to find ways to move that home.
The community is trying to come up with a plan to move the home safely off the cliff, but they may need help from outside entities like the state of Alaska to do that. Reporting in Nome, I'm Davis Hovey.
The State Department of Environmental Conservation is recommending residents of more than a dozen communities boil water for drinking, cooking, and cleaning as a precaution following the huge storm that hit western Alaska. In the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta area, those communities are CHIVAC, Kungiginak, Quigilingok, Nunamikwa, and Skamon Bay. In the Seward Peninsula area, there are notices for Buckland, Elam, Golovin, Koyuk, Teller, and Unalakleet. Residents of Platinum, St. George, Diomede, and Gamble are also advised to boil water. Water should be boiled for at least 2 minutes before use. Gene Wiseman, section chief of the Rural and Community Health Systems for the state, said in a public health presentation today that he had not heard of any storm impacts on sewage systems. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, why some Alaskans say now is the time for a constitutional convention.
Then we can look at the incredibly long list of things that need correction.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
Residents of Shaktulik are back in their homes after many evacuated to the school when the remnants of Typhoon Murbach hit. The storm washed away the berm, that's a man-made embankment that protects the village from the sea. KTOO's Claire Strempel reports.
There's a lot of cleanup to do. Logs from the berm are scattered around Shaktulik. Agnes Tukuk, Shaktulik council member and the school secretary, says people are still assessing damage to their homes and properties, but kids are back in school.
We have everyone here. We're right now just trying to be there for our children, getting them back, you know, into what we are trying to say normal, I guess, after what we experienced.
She says her generation built the berm. That's after elders saw how much land was lost due to erosion. Children in Shaktulik now have always known the protection of the berm. She says it was a symbol of their security. One student asked, what are we going to do now? Tukuk said if the next storm comes before the village can rebuild the berm, the community could get wiped out.
My understanding is that our organizations don't have any funding to rebuild right now. We need financial assistance ASAP. Our lives are at stake.
Mayor Lars Sukiak says Shaktulik is pressed for time. He expects another storm in November. He said planes can land at the local airstrip, but there's hardly any air traffic, so grocery store shelves are looking a little bare. Sukiak is also concerned about erosion from the storm. The village sits on a narrow spit of land between the Norton Sound and the Shaktulik River. If the ocean breaches the river, it could pollute it with salt water.
The risk of losing the freshwater source and Shaktulik becoming an island.
Logs washed into the community. But local councilman Eugene Asiksik says the berm kept water out of homes.
My ankles didn't even get wet, and I didn't even have my high heels on.
He and his family sheltered briefly at the school, but he said the village was prepared. They've seen big storms before and had systems in place.
The electrical system, you know, held up. The only thing we did was disconnect the electrical wire to our winter water pumping station, which was a good thing. And there was a lot of preparation.
He says they likely have enough water for the remainder of the month. By then, he's hoping the village will be able to pump water normally for winter. Most boats weathered the storm. Asiksik says one sank in place. Governor Mike Dunleavy is expected to be in Shaktulik this week to survey the damage. Reporting from Juneau, I'm Claire Strempel.
Alaska's former acting attorney general Ed Sniffen has been indicted on charges of sexual abuse of a minor that allegedly occurred in 1991, according to the Department of Law. The allegations first came to light in 2021 through reporting by the Anchorage Daily News and ProPublica. The news organization's stories included interviews with a woman who said Sniffen had sex with her when she was 17 and on a mock trial team trip to New Orleans that Sniffen helped chaperone. In most cases, the age of consent in Alaska is 16, but in cases that involve an alleged perpetrator in a position of authority, like a teacher, the age of consent is 18. Sniffen, now 58, became the state's acting attorney general in 2020 following a sexual harassment scandal involving his predecessor, Kevin Clarkson, who resigned as a result of a different ADN and ProPublica investigation. According to the ADN, Sniffen resigned in 2021 as the newsrooms were preparing stories about the allegations against him, just days after Governor Mike Dunleavy had appointed Sniffen to officially be the attorney general, pending the legislature's approval. The Department of Law appointed a special prosecutor to look into Sniffen's case. Sniffen was originally charged in May. Like other felony accusations, the case went before a grand jury, resulting in the indictment announced today. Sniffen is set to appear in court to answer to the indictment on Monday. This November, Alaskans will decide whether to revamp the state's constitution. The once-in-a-decade constitutional convention question is usually voted down by a wide margin. But this year, questions about the permanent fund dividend, Alaska's fiscal woes, and abortion access have some saying now is the time to vote yes, while others say the document continues to serve the state well. For Alaska Public Media, reporter Aaron McKinstry explains.
The hour appointed by the Alaska Territorial Legislature.
For 3 months during the winter of 1955 and 1956, 55 delegates from around Alaska created the state's founding document.
I do accordingly, as governor of this territory, call the convention to order.
31-year-old Vic Fisher was among them.
Victor Fisher.
Now he's 98 and the last surviving delegate.
We all had the same goal. Do everything possible to become a state.
Being late to the statehood game, the Alaska delegates had the benefit of pulling the best parts from other states' constitutions and learning from past mistakes.
It is short and specific, laying out the foundation for the state without going into a lot of detail that would require changes.
The 12,000-word document has been updated 28 times since its passage, with voter-approved amendments to allow for the permanent fund dividend, prohibit sex discrimination, and create a right to privacy clause, for example. But changing the Constitution on a broader and more fundamental level requires a constitutional convention. Alaska is one of 14 states that regularly asks voters directly. Fisher says they wanted to give people in the future a way to revise the Constitution.
So we wouldn't have a document that just sat on the shelf somewhere and stayed unchanged.
Fisher can imagine a time when a constitutional convention could be necessary. But right now, he worries about the cost, the current political climate, and the possibility of outside interests and money influencing changes.
They could throw big monies, dark monies, at a constitutional convention and create a situation that would be just desperately miserable for Alaska.
But Republican Senator Robert Myers disagrees. He sees a constitutional convention as an opportunity for long-term planning to address fiscal questions around spending caps, the permanent fund dividend, and taxation.
Really, what we've seen over the last few years is some very significant changes in our economy and how things operate in Alaska. And our Constitution needs to reflect some of those changes.
Myers isn't alone. A group of conservative activists and politicians have joined forces to create a formal campaign called Yes Convention to advocate for the vote and not just to address fiscal issues. The recent Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe versus Wade has some looking at how Alaska's right to privacy clause protects abortion access. Advocates like Alaska Independence Party Chairman Bob Byrd want to look at changing Alaska's judicial system, altering the education system, and more.
The PFD is the spark, but when you get the spark like that and there's no limit to what a constitutional convention might produce, then we can look at the incredibly long list of things that need correction.
Byrd says it's important for voters to understand that they're the ones in charge of the process.
The people get to control whether or not there will be a constitutional convention. And then we'll get to vote as to who our delegates will be. And then we're going to get to vote as to whether we like what is produced by the convention.
A yes vote raises a lot of questions, like how much it would cost, when it would be held, and how delegates would be chosen. One white paper put an estimated cost above $16 million. And Alaskans could spend all that money and time and then reject the changes at the polls. Former Republican Senator Kathy Kiesel says it's too risky.
This is not the right time. With emotions running high on so many different issues,
to try to sit down and craft a solid document that would continue to provide stability and a positive future for our state.
Giesel and Fisher are co-chairs of Defend Our Constitution, a broad-based coalition against holding a constitutional convention. They agree that the current constitution provides a strong foundation for Alaska.
A new constitutional convention can take the existing convention and dump it. Just start from scratch and do something completely different. And I'm not sure that makes any sense.
Voters will decide whether to hold the first convention since statehood on November 8th. For Alaska Public Media, I'm Erin McKinstry.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com. NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
Alaska has the highest homicide rate in the nation for women killed by men for the seventh year in a row. The state has been first or second on that list for a decade. That's according to a report released Tuesday from the Violence Policy Center, a Washington, D.C. nonprofit that advocates for gun control. The report details findings from the most recent data, which is from 2020. In that year, 12 Alaska women were killed by men. More than 90% of the victims were killed by someone they knew, and a quarter of them were killed with guns. The report says state lawmakers should prioritize ending the epidemic of deadly violence against Alaska women, and particularly Alaska Native women. Women in Alaska were killed by men at more than twice the average national rate. Alaska Native women were killed at 10 times the rate of white women. The Federal Office of Violence Against Women is holding its annual government-to-government tribal consultation meetings in Anchorage this week. The goal is to figure out how to administer tribal funds to make Indigenous women safer and to strengthen the federal response to these violent crimes. Law enforcement in Kodiak seized more than $650,000 worth of fentanyl, meth, and heroin this weekend. KMXD's Kirsten Dobrath reports the bust was part of a major investigation into drug trafficking on the island.
Alaska State Troopers say more than 11,000 blue fentanyl pills were seized on Friday. That's nearly two pills for every person living within Kodiak city limits. Sergeant Garrett Frost supervises the troopers' statewide drug enforcement unit in Kodiak. He says Friday's bust was the largest seizure of fentanyl to date on the island.
There is a large consumer base in Kodiak, and there is a lot of money to be made by the sale of not only fentanyl, but meth, heroin, and other drugs.
Local law enforcement, including members of the Kodiak Police Department, Coast Guard Investigative Service, and troopers, also confiscated about 3 pounds of crystal meth, 89 grams of tar heroin, 5 handguns, and more than $58,000 in cash during Friday's seizure. The street value of the drugs is $656,000, according to the troopers. Police arrested 55-year-old Mark Nason and 42-year-old Adam Ross, both of Kodiak, and charged them with multiple counts of misconduct involving a controlled substance. Nason was also charged with misconduct involving weapons. Ross was released on $10,000 bail Monday. Nason is due in court for a preliminary hearing next week. Sergeant Frost says many of the drugs are linked to cartels in Mexico, and the seizure and arrests are just one part of a larger investigation into drug trafficking on the island.
There's a lot more going on in Kodiak than this specific investigation. I'm sure there's other individuals out there who are doing the same thing on the island, or these these folks were working with other individuals.
The seizure and arrest come as local law enforcement and public health officials have been sounding the alarm over an increase of overdoses on the island, largely due to fentanyl. Alaska has been seeing a surge in fentanyl overdoses statewide, too. Kodiak residents can pick up the life-saving drug Narcan, which reverses the effects of an overdose, for free at the Kodiak Public Health Center. Meanwhile, Frost says anyone with information about drug activity can report it anonymously by calling the Alaska State Troopers Kodiak office and asking to speak with a drug investigator. Members of the public can also report tips anonymously via the Kodiak Crime Stoppers hotline and website. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
Fort Wainwright personnel in Interior Alaska will move a historic UH-1 Huey helicopter from the airfield to the post's main gate Thursday. That's where it will serve as a symbol of the Army and Army Aviation. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Fort Wainwright officials want to move the UH-1 Huey from its perch at Ladd Army Airfield to the main gate as a sort of tribute to the post and the service it's a part of.
It is a nice feature that adds a more Army historic feel to the gate area.
Post spokesperson Eve Baker says they also want to follow the example of many other Army installations that park vintage military hardware near their main entrances, like the two tanks outside of Fort Greely's main gate.
So we're trying to do that up here to increase the team spirit, so to speak, as people come on base to work. They see the military equipment and they know they're going to work for the Army and serving the United States.
Baker says folks who've been around Fairbanks for a while may recognize the Huey because it had sat in that area back in the 1990s before post officials moved it 15 years ago.
It was in 2007 that it was moved on post near the headquarters building before being relocated over to the airfield. And now it's coming back to the front gate.
The Bell UH-1 Iroquois earned a reputation as a rugged workhorse during the Vietnam conflict, especially for airborne assault, medevac, and transport. Bell Helicopter built more than 16,000 Hueys, which the Army designated as the HU-1. That's where aviators came up with the nickname Huey, which stuck even after the chopper was redesignated the UH-1. The Army flew Hueys for 42 years before they were retired 6 years ago, but many refurbished UH-1s are still flying for governmental agencies and commercial aviation companies. The Sikorsky UH-60 Blackhawk and its variants replaced the Hueys, and now UH-60s flying in and out of Ladd Field are a common sight in the skies above Fairbanks. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. And wherever you get your podcasts, we're also on Spotify now. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in Chivac, Davis Hovey in Nome, Claire Strempel in Juneau, Aaron McKinstry in Anchorage, Kirsten Dobrath in Kodiak, and Tim Ellis in Delta Junction. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, or just want to get in touch, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Dave Emmert, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank, Alaska, celebrating 100 years of helping Alaskans shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at fnbalaska.com.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.